My name is Linda, and I am an alcoholic. I want to thank Sam for asking me to come. It's always a privilege to speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I get sober. My sobriety date is 8/8/89. I get sober in Massachusetts. And in Massachusetts, it's done a little bit different. We have speaker meetings. That's how I get sober. And when I arrived in Virginia, I did 18 years here in Virginia, in Massachusetts. I was sober there and then came here, and I was six, I've been here 6 years. And one of the things I miss most is being able to tell my story in its entirety. And one of the things we stress back home is that I need to visit where I came from. And if I don't visit where I was, there's a good chance I'll go back to being who I was. And being able to tell my story lets me look at where I was and where I am today. And with that, I will just start with a little bit about me as a kid. I was born a worrisome child. At the age of 9, I had an ulcer. I had no reason to be a fearful child. But that's who I was from the get-go. I was afraid of everybody. I was incredibly shy. I know you would find that hard to believe today because that's something I've outgrown, but I was incredibly shy as a child. I hid behind my mother's leg. I didn't like coming into an empty home. My mom was an at-home mom, and if she wasn't there when I got home, I would be crazy looking for her, you know. My family was everything. So you've got this fearful child that never feels good enough, and I can remember at an early age I was paired with these kids. I'm fairly intelligent, or so they told me in school, and they paired me with these other kids that were what I perceived to be more intelligent than I and had better skills than I. And I would be, like, so afraid, like, because I wasn't as smart as them, but yet they paired me with them, so I had to have brought something to the table, but you couldn't make me believe that. And so you take this child that has got, you know, the doctor used to say at the age of 9 I was going to have gray hair by the time I was 11. I had ulcers at 9 for no apparent reason. And when you take that into high school, you know, I am not a joiner. You know, I had one childhood friend that was my childhood friend forever. You know, I didn't mix well with others, and I didn't know how, and I didn't know why. And I'm one of these people that, even as a child, either you really, really like me or you really, really dislike me. There's no in-between, and I knew that early on. Either you liked me or you hated me, and that made me really uncomfortable because there were only two camps for me. And I really instilled strong things. And so I never felt comfortable with where I was or who I was, whether I was with people. And I'll end with this. I was in junior high, and I met these kids, and I had a fairly good vocabulary because I read. Right? Reading was a way to stay in my own little world. And they used to say Linda with her $5 words. And I learned to dummy down the way I spoke. And, of course, I've lost that use of that vocabulary because I stopped using it because I wanted to be accepted. And I didn't want to be smart. And when they asked me to be in the National Honor Society, I didn't. So 16, never been drunk. I was dating. At 16 was the magic age in my family. You know, I could go out with a boy. I could get in a car. I could go on my first date. I could wear makeup. 16 was the magic age. I met a boy. He was my first love. And he said, "You've never been drunk." And that was unbelievable because all these kids had been drinking for years and I had not been. All my friends had been drinking and I had not been. I'm not really a joiner. I stand in the back. If I don't want to do it, you're not going to make me do it. Anyway, we decided they were going to get me drunk, and it was on Tango, and it was terrible. I vomited everywhere. It was awful. I don't understand why people liked it. I never liked the taste of liquor. And then, you know, I didn't really drink much after that. But what happened was at 18, I had a significant loss in my life. I met a boy after that boy, and that was my high school sweetheart. I met a man, or a boy. I was 18. He was 25. And I fell in love, and I thought we were going to get married. And I wanted to marry him desperately. And he lived in Chicago. And anyway, the long and short of it is it didn't work out for us. And I had no idea how to cope. And I was hanging around with a girl that was 18, same age as me, but her boyfriend was significantly older, and they drank in bar rooms. And so I used to go with them and hang in bars. Now, I'm a barroom drinker. I love bar rooms. You know, I don't drink in the house. I don't drink in the backyard. I don't drink at your barbecue. I don't drink at your birthday party. I sit at a bar from when it opens or when I'm out of work until when it closes. You know, I like it when, you know, the vampire, the door opens, because the light comes in. And that's where I spent all of my downtime, was in a bar. And I learned to use bar rooms at the age of 18 to distract me. You know, I liked the nonsense and the craziness in there. And it was my coping mechanism. It made me not think. And then shortly thereafter, I found alcohol. And when I drank, what happened for me was, it didn't make me feel 10 feet tall or anything like that, but as a worrisome child, nobody was meaner than me. The inside dialogue in my head was always like, you should have. You could have done better. Why did you do that? You should have said this, and you shouldn't have said that, and you should have acted like this, and you shouldn't have. And nobody was meaner to me than me. And when I drank, it settled down. And when I drank, I wasn't mean to me anymore. The voices sort of calmed down in my head. And when I talk about them voices, like to my mother, she looks at me like I'm crazy, but I see people nodding here. Like, my mother's not alcoholic, and she doesn't have that those voices, or she doesn't listen to the chatter. I listen to the chatter. And the chatter is bad up there for me. And so when I drank, I felt relief. And the relief was from myself and all the pressure and the intensity that I put on myself. And so off went my story. I'm not really going to get much more into that. All I'm going to tell you is my 25th year. You know, somewhere between 18 and 25, I had one drunk driving. My 25th year, I picked up my second. You know, the first one, I was mortified. I'd never been before the court. You know, I didn't know what to do. My mother wouldn't go with me. It was my first resentment ever because she wouldn't come. The woman I worked with came with me because I was early 20s. I don't even know. I was 21 maybe. And I was just horrified, and I was embarrassed, and I wanted to die, and I didn't, I'm a nice girl. I don't know what to do in a courtroom. And second time I got arrested, it was no big deal. I knew what to say. I knew what to do. It was no shame. You know, I've been there, done that. And that's kind of sad. And one of the things is my mom abhors drunk drivers. I mean, she just thinks that's the greatest sin. And I was a habitual drunk driver, and she hated that more than anything. You know, and So at 25, somewhere, my birthday's in March, somewhere shortly thereafter, I get my second drunk driving. You know, somewhere in the fall, I pull this horror show drunk at my mom's house, and what happened is really not important. That's my fist stuff. But it produced a great amount of shame for me. And what happened for me was I moved out of my house. I was in a grail. I remember the worst of it, but I don't remember who picked me up. I don't remember where I spent the night. I don't remember exactly what happened or what transpired, but I came home the next morning, my head hung down, took all my clothes out of the house, and left. That time, I thought maybe, just maybe, I might be having trouble with alcohol, and I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous a couple years earlier. My brother got sober. I went to Edge Hill to, you know, Newport, and had to do the family thing, and I knew a little bit, but not a lot. So I went to investigate a meeting. It was a Wednesday night. I'll never forget it. It was really dark in there, and I cried. The whole thing, I cried. And I sat in the back, and they were so nice to me. They gave me a book and a bumper sticker. Now tell me, like, I didn't want to die. Like, I'm 25, and I've got a big book and a bumper sticker, and I don't want anybody to know I'm here, and I'm sobbing, and I'm like, I'm watching people, and I'm like, okay, I don't belong. I do not belong. And I walked out the door and never came back. And then September happened. And then December happened, and so for December, I went on vacation to bring in the new year by myself in Florida. And I've been working with this guy that I really like, and I had a really good job, and he was really good to me. And anyway, the long and the short of it is I went on vacation for 5 days. It was one long drunk, and I don't morning drink, but I do on vacation. And it was a horror show. I came home, and I ended up sleeping at the office because it was snowing and I couldn't get home and I was drunk and I almost missed my plane in Florida because I was drinking and it was just a mess. And two things happened. I knew a boy that I was dating here when I was drinking and he was a nice boy. And I really liked him, but I was not a nice girl. And I drank and I did what I wanted, where I wanted, when I wanted, with whoever I wanted, no matter who it hurt. And I didn't set out to be like that. And that wasn't the way I was raised. But that's how I ended up at the end, and I didn't want to hurt this boy because he was a nice boy. And I met him in Florida on this drunken craziness, and we hung out, and I mean, I had been drinking forever. I was, like, blind drunk. I mean, he kept saying, Linda, and I couldn't even visualize. I had one hand over my eye going, where did you go to school? Who did you? And it was him, and it was awful. The next morning we wake up, and I'm, like, thinking, I'm curled in a ball, and I'm sick, and I'm feeling awful, and that was his last picture of me, and I was really upset because he was a nice kid, and I'm thinking, like, that's all he's going to remember of me. And he kept saying, I'll call you when we get back to Boston. I was leaving in 2 days. He never called, imagine. And I get home, and the guy I'd been dating for a long time called, and he said, what are you doing? And I said, I can't get out of this vacation mode. And I know now from coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would have denied that a bunch of years ago, that I couldn't stop drinking. And that was my first experience, like, I couldn't stop drinking. Like, I just couldn't stop. I didn't want to stop. And so we went on a 3-day run. And all you need to know about that, it was like my measuring stick for alcoholism was employability. And I was becoming unemployable. Now that was the worst thing in the world. So how I got sober was very important. My drunk log is really, to me, not very important to you because we drink the same way, we do the same things. And what's important to me is how I got sober. And, you know, and I'll just say this. You know, I really didn't know I was a drunk, but I used to say all the time to my friends, let's go get drunk. And my mother would be appalled, and she's like, who says that? And I would be like, who doesn't? You know, like, I never even thought that there was anything wrong with that. I never said, let's get a drink. It was like, let's get drunk. To me, there was no other reason to drink. And that was always my intent. My intent was never to have a drink. And I never lied about that. And so I never even thought there was anything wrong with that until my mother said, who says that? I'm like, who doesn't? And then, so I go off, and so I disappear for 3 days. Now, I have my own apartment at this time. My mother's away and my father away, and I'm at my mom's house because my mom has this full liquor cabinet and my dad, and we've been on this run, and the phone rings. I don't think it's anybody. Who would be calling me at my mom's house? And it's my boss. And he said, Linda. And my heart dropped. I started to cry. And that's all he said was, Linda. And I can still feel it. Like, my face gets red. And he said, I think you owe me an explanation. And I said, I'm having trouble boozing drugs. I'm having trouble with alcohol. And I started to cry. And there was silence on the other line, end of the line. And he said to me, what do you want to do? And, you know, defiance, arrogance, just obnoxiousness is generally my fallback when I'm in this place where I don't know how to do anything and I feel cornered. I said, well, I might as well go on one last drink because, I mean, I'm going to get sober. And what had happened before the phone call was I called my brother who had been sober, and he was living in Florida, and I said, when I wake up and the sun comes up, I'm going to think it's just a bad night. Please set this rolling because I know when I get up in the morning, I'm not going to want to get sober. So he called, and then my boss called. He got it all lined up for me, and then my boss called, and I told him I was leaving to get sober. And he said, I was waiting for my parents to get back. So I called my parents in Germany, and they were visiting family, and I said to my mother, when you get home, I won't be here. And she said, where will you be this time? I did a lot of geographical cures. I was always getting in my car, going somewhere else, and living somewhere else in other states and things. And I said, I'm going to go to detox, Mom. And she said, talk to your father. She hands the phone to my father. And my dad says, can you wait till we get home? We'll be home the day after tomorrow or tomorrow or something like that. And I'm like, okay. And so the big fight was with the insurance companies. I wanted a 28-day treatment center. They wanted me. They said I wasn't bad enough. They wanted me to go outpatient. Now, I am a barroom drinker every night. I don't care how sick I am. I say I'm going home, and my car ends up in front of the bar. I drive, and I don't even know how it's there. I just am like, man, I was going home. I'm here. I might as well go in. And it was like automatic pilot. So for me, I knew, I believed, coming to Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't going to. I needed a timeout. I needed an adult timeout other than jail. And that happened to be a detox for me and a rehab center. So my parents, this was the most crucial part of my story, are just working class Joes. They don't have any money, you know. My father's very conscientious. I cry. It just breaks my heart. And they don't have a whole lot of money. So my dad says, we'll pay. And I want to go 28 days. And he's like, we can only afford 14, the 3 days in detox and the 14 days of treatment. And my hair's on fire. And I'm like, but I want. And so I'm like, okay. So my parents pay. Now, you have to admit, we are a pretty risky bet at best. And so they took what little savings they had, and they put me in this place, and it was called Gosnold, and it was on the Cape. And I'll never forget this as long as I live. So they're driving me down to the Cape. They're taking me to lunch. It's my last supper. That's how I feel. And it's my, you know, it's a gin mill. It's a restaurant. And I'm looking at the bar, of course, right? And I'm looking at all the bottles, the clear and the amber and the crème de menthe, which I never drink, but it's green. And I'm looking at all the colors. And I'm terrified. I'm like, oh, my God, what did I do? Can I do this? Do I want to do this? I am like, now I'm mad because now I'm in a place where I'm damned if I do, damned if I don't. And I don't know if I want to go, if I don't want to go. I don't know if I can do it or if I can't do it. And I'm terrified, and I'm mad. And so I choke down my meal, I choke down my fear, and they take me to this place, and the sign says, a bridge back. And in my head, I'm all about sarcasm and just being obnoxious, and I say to myself, bridge back to what? You know, I'm grumbling in my head, and they drop me off, and they leave me. And I'm like,
horrified.
Now, I'm in treatment, you know, the three-day detox. I was lucky I wasn't physically addicted to anything. And so that was kind of like 3 days of agony, of nothing to do but wait. I go in on Monday or something like that for treatment, and they're asking me to do things that are contrary to the way I've been living. They're asking me to pray. They asked me to get on my knees, and I literally raised my hand and went, "You mean figuratively, right? You don't mean literally." And they're like, "Literally." I'm like, "Literally, you want me to get on my knees?" And he's like, "Yes." And I can remember the man dropped to his knees to say a prayer, and I was actually embarrassed. Like, I have all this spiritual prejudice, right? And so now, and I know I have all this spiritual prejudice, and I'm embarrassed for this man on his knees. Okay, that tells you how well I am. And this is how I'm in treatment. And so I was like, it was beyond comprehension for me. And so the first week I did, I played games, you know. I talked to the boys. I didn't listen. I did whatever. I did all the things I weren't supposed to do. And I would, they would let us walk around the building, and it was in January. I went to treatment in 88. So it's January 1988, and I'm walking around the building. It's snowy, and we're building snowmen. I'm 25. And I kept saying, if my parents didn't pay, I would leave. If the insurance company paid, I would leave. I can't believe I'm staying here. I hate it here. And one time I called, and I was sobbing, and I said to my parents, and I said to my dad, who loves me. He would do anything. I was like, "Daddy, this is a terrible place. It's awful. You have to come get me. It's a horrible place. It's terrible. Oh, my God, we have to go." And the phone rang right after that. It was my brother, I learned a couple of years later. And he, my father said, "It's a terrible place. We have to go get your sister. It's a terrible place." And my brother said, "Leave her." And he left me. So the second week, they told me if I didn't do something, they were going to throw me out. They were done. I needed to be serious. And then I started to hear some things, and begrudgingly to me. Back then, meetings were an hour and a half. Meetings would come in at night. And I'm sorry, but for me, it was the longest hour and a half of my life. I would count the ceiling tiles. I'd talk to the kid next to me. I'd read the paper if it was on the table. I couldn't understand any of it. It was beyond my comprehension. And so, but I went. Only two people that came to visit me, as sad as this is, my mom and my dad, and my alcohol counselor from my second driving that was appointed to me from the court. It was the only two people from the court that came to visit me. How bad? How pathetic is that? So I get out, and I do my 14 days. I hear some things, and they told me to go to a meeting as soon as I get out. I get out, and the alcohol counselor, I can't tell you his name today, but I can picture him perfectly. I don't remember his name, said, "I will take you to your first meeting." And on, I get out on a Saturday afternoon. On Saturday night, he picked me up. He took me to my first meeting. And God, could you believe the group that spoke was one of the groups that came into God's and all that I hated the first time, liked them less on the second. And that was the speaker, and I don't remember anything they said. He gave me a meaningless book. He circled meetings. And he said, "Kid, if you want it, you go get it. These are the meetings I think you should go to, and go." And he didn't hold my hand. And that was the only meeting he took me to. And that was the best thing he could have done for me. It's Sunday morning. I go to Brockton High Sunday morning meeting. There's 150 people in that meeting. Two things, very important things happened to me. This is God in my life. My parents pay for my detox, so I stay. I have a healthy respect for money and my parents' lack of money, so I stay. I go to my alcohol counselor comes and gets me, and I go to meeting on my own, and I go to the one he tells me. I walk in the door, and some man comes up to me and says, "I think you're new." And, you know, I will present very well. Clint is laughing, and I will be very pleasant to you, but in my head, I'm going, "Get that." I have this dialogue going in my head that's very different than that's going across my face. And I'm like, "No, I'm okay." And he's like, "No, I really..." He's like, I'm like, "Oh, we're talking." And then he says, "I would like you to meet somebody." And he introduces me to a woman. He says, "I really think she should be your sponsor." And I keep saying, "I wish you'd mind your own business." I'm like, and I'm being gracious as I can be at the time. I'm like, "Thank you very much. It's really nice to meet you, but I think I'm going to go sit over there." Don't remember anything that was said. I met this woman. Don't even know what she looks like. Met this woman. Met this man. The only other thing I remember is Jimmy Pirelli got his 19-year medallion. I literally had 19 days. And I sat at the back and I said, "There is no way that man has 19 years." I didn't believe it for a second. I just couldn't comprehend anybody could have 19 years. And I can remember saying to somebody, "Really? Is that true? No, that can't be true." And they're like, "No, that's true." And those were the only things I took out of that meeting. Lost my license for drunk driving. God again in my life. I get on that dang bus, and who's on it but that woman that should be my sponsor? I'm like, "Oh, my God, there's a conspiracy." And so, I mean, God has been always good to me. He has put things in my life, even though I don't want them. So I say to her, her name's Anne-Marie. I say, Anne-Marie, how do I find a sponsor? She was seriously plugged into AA. She was Miss AA. She was a big book thumper before big book thumping was a big deal. It was a lot of years ago, and she was into the grapevine. She worked in the industry, and so she the next morning, she came on the bus with this article from the grapevine about how to pick a sponsor. I read it, and I went, oh, my God, I'll be drunk. I'm like, will you be my sponsor? And she said yes. No. God bless Anne Marie. She had the patience of a saint. She took the bus, not because she wanted to, because she had to go to work too. And we read the big book every day for months. And every day I tried to find a line in the book why I was different and why it didn't apply to me. And she would say to me all the time, Linda, I have never seen anybody too stupid to get sober, but I've seen many people that are way too smart, and you're going to be way too smart to get sober. And I was always on the debating committee, you know, and Anne-Marie taught me things like this that I don't hear. You know, where I come from, we have, you know, like Boy Scout things, and it says, always hears but for the grace of God. Easy does it. First things first. Never have to be alone. Listen to learn. Learn to listen to learn. Learn to listen. We heard things like, you know, my sponsor was not very nice. She used to tell me that I needed to go to a group meeting. I had to go to a group. I had to go to a step meeting. And I had to go to meetings every night. She told me at a step meeting I wasn't allowed to share because I had nothing of value to share. Deflation of ego at depth. She said, do not think you have anything to say of any value. And I'm like, wow, that's harsh. That was really harsh. And she was right. Either I'm spreading the message or I'm spreading the illness. And at that time, I'm spreading the illness. I know nothing about spreading the message because I don't even know what the message is. I can't even hear the message that's being delivered. So she wouldn't let me speak. Where I come from, you can't speak from a podium until we have 90 days. And then it's not scripted, but you are told, like, you know, gosh, you don't do this, you know, it's, you know, you tell your experience as best you can, and they start you off in a detox, you know, they want you to try to spread the message. So, Anne-Marie and I are on our way, and I'm learning all about alcoholism and recovery from there from, and so she tells me I need to join a group, and I'm like, probably, I join her group, right? It's easy. She's, you know, it's a way in. I don't have to worry about meeting people. She introduces me to people. I get to spend some time with her, and I go to step meetings. Somewhere around 5 months sober, I'm pregnant. And it's no accident, but I'm pregnant. And she said to me, and I don't know if this is right or wrong, but this is my story. She told me that I could only do, from that moment on, I could only do 3 meetings a week, that to raise a family, I couldn't be at a meeting 7 nights a week. I needed to be home with my child. And so she told me I needed to go to my group meeting, I needed to go to my step meeting, and I needed to go to a commitment. She said there were many ways to get meetings. I can get it on the telephone. I can get it through AA speaker tapes. I can get it in the literature. I didn't have to be in a meeting 7 nights a week. Now, when my rear end was on fire, I was at a meeting. And it was quite often my rear end was on fire in early sobriety with a newborn baby. And I was really lucky that my parents understood. But she was right. When I got better, it was like 3 meetings a week. I needed to raise my child. When I got here, the steps were really difficult for me. You know, powerless, I looked it up in the dictionary. It means to be without power. That's useless to me. I thought I was really powerful because I am all about self-sufficiency. That is my greatest character flaw, is self-sufficiency. Now, I just heard Beth speak, and she talked all about self-centeredness and all these definitions, and I laughed, and so I looked it up in the dictionary today. And one of them is self-sufficiency. I had no idea self-centeredness is self-sufficiency. And so independence is another part of self-centeredness, which I really don't. And I pride myself on being independent. But what I've learned recently, that means I can't live in community. And I've never been able to live in community. And I learned how to live in community and fellowship here. That's how I learned community was through the fellowship. So I could not imagine I was powerless over alcohol, but I knew that my life was unmanageable. I had that down pat. I was losing my job. You know, I was behaving in ways I didn't want to behave. I was behaving in ways I wasn't raised to behave. My moral, standing was dropping. I kept, you know, oh, this was acceptable. All the things that were unacceptable were becoming acceptable in my life. So I knew my life was unmanageable, and I could do with that. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore me to sanity? Well, I didn't think I was insane. When I got here, either I didn't hear or people didn't say it as clearly as I hear here. Is that I didn't realize the insanity was the way I viewed the first drink. You know what I mean? That I would know that I didn't have a defense against the first drink. And to take the first drink was the insanity. That every time I took the first drink, my life became unmanageable. And everything went to pot. And so, but I didn't know that. I thought the sanity part was I would stop doing those crazy things I was doing when I drank. You know, driving drunk, ending up in different states, ending up in places I didn't know where I was. I didn't have any idea. So I let it go. And one of the things for me is if I didn't understand, and because I was always on the, I just let it go. And I figured at some point I'd get understanding. I tried not to fight. Made a decision to turn my life over to the care of God. Who knows what that is? Because I am loaded with spiritual prejudice. I don't believe in God. I think God is for people that are weak, can't manage their own lives. Again, look at my life. One, I'm unmanageable, can't manage their own lives. And I totally don't want anything to do with the God concept. And AA is all about God. That's it. It is the God concept. So what I did know was that, for me, my God was a group of drunks. It was an AA group. I knew that people transformed in this room. And I knew there was a power here that was bigger than me that worked. And I saw it over and over and over again. And that was my power, greater than myself. I remember the first time I went to a meeting that I knew somebody that spoke at a podium. And I knew by the way he delivered his message and the way he spoke that he was different. And I knew how he drank. He was the bartender at the bar I drank at. I watched him get arrested several times. I'd been in several places with him doing several things that we probably should not have been doing, you know, acting badly with a bunch of different people, you know, just drunken craziness. And I knew he was different. And I knew AA was working. That was the first day I got hope. Because I am your original doubting Thomas. I don't believe anything anybody says. I want proof. So do you know how hard it is to come into a room where it's mostly on blind faith and that they're asking me to do things where I don't understand how it's going to change my life, but I'm supposed to let it? And that was really hard. I didn't get like how sitting in this in those chairs listening to somebody like me speak was going to change my life. Again, I had all that chatter, and it was negative in my head. And I was about 13 years sober, and I saw on the wall the sign that said, change your thoughts and change your world. And that was sitting at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, listening to somebody at a podium, helped me change the way I thought. That completely changed my world. But I didn't know that. And so it was really hard for me. I made a searching and fearless moral inventory the best I could with my sponsor. And for me, it was harms done to others. I had so many and so much guilt. That was my first fourth year. I had a list that it was this long. I was riddled with guilt of the people I had hurt and the bad acts I had committed, you know, of hurting people and acting inappropriately. And that was the best I could do, you know. Considering I couldn't get past the word powerless, could you imagine me trying to figure out what humility was or tolerance or intolerance and all of those sort of subtle, no, not subtle, but things that I couldn't imagine that I had. I couldn't even get what self-centered was. When I heard Beth talk about, what did she say? I'm one of those. A lot of things come easy to me, but I will not do anything in public that's going to make me look bad if I haven't done it once and I know I can do it. She said that's self-centered. I get that. I don't want anybody to see me look bad. Self-centered. I don't want you to know that I don't know. Why? Who said that I'm supposed to know everything? Who put that belief in my head? Where did that come from me? Self-centered. You know, and I didn't know that. So my fourth step was basically, and that saved me from having to do my eighth step because it was done. I had hurt a great many people. I did my fifth step as best I could. You know, I told her everything. There was one thing I held back. There was one thing when I told you that last, that thing in September that happened in my house that I would, in front of my mom, I would never tell anybody. I kept that back. And took a couple and it came out. And the greatest joy for me was when the woman looked at me and she said, my God, Linda, if that's the worst thing you've ever done. And there was such relief. I had such shame, and she didn't make me feel shameful. And that was unbelievable. And I could let that go. And I, when I made my amends to my mom about that, she's like, I often wondered if you remembered what happened that night. And I'm like, oh, my God. Unfortunately, it wasn't in a blackout. I remember in all its unglorified happenings. But, you know, it took me a while, but I did several, and I got better. It's like, I hear it's like peeling an onion, you know. I had to slowly take the layers off, and it took me a while. Six and seven were really hard. One of the things I want to, I've been working on six and seven a lot lately. Six and seven, they just say, six is just willingness, I'm willing. And one of the things I just wanted to read, I've been doing a lot of work on Drop the Rock, and I'm not really good at remembering what were written, but a couple things that really, really jumped out at me was that steps, it says in the 12 and 12 that step six is a lifetime. I have to be willing, it's a daily surrender, and I have to be willing to daily surrender who I am. And one of the things I was reading about when, you know, it says we want to hold on to some of our character defects, but think about it. Like, I don't anymore. Why would I want to hang on to anything that makes me uncomfortable, like anxiety, resentment, hate, selfishness, you know, disharmony. Why would I want to hang on to those things that make my life uncomfortable and might return me to a state away? So I am completely ready to have God take those things away from me. But I go back to being me. That's why I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's my uneloquent way of saying, I need to come here so I remember who I am and to strive to be better daily. Because if I don't, I go back to being who I am. I go back to being the girl with all the underlying causes without treatment. And I don't want to. I don't want to be that girl. And one of the things I really like, it says that we must act as if it has already taken place. It is my job to act and behave like the change has occurred. And one of the things I used to say all the time from the podium, which is that is much more eloquently put than I could ever say, and it says, by doing this, the process of change happens. And I remember talking about in early sobriety, hanging around with people with sobriety. One of my sponsor's favorite sayings was, you can't dry off with a wet towel. No idea what that means, you know, that just sounds like gibberish. But what she was trying to tell me is, I can't get sober with people that don't know how to get sober, that have 30, 60, 90 days. We're just as squirrely and crazy, and we have no defense against the first drink. But I need to hang around with people that know. So when I'm squirrely and crazy, they're not going to say, let's drink. They're going to say, let's have a cup of coffee and talk, and just say, it's going to be okay, Linda. And so I remember feeling like hanging around with people with sobriety whose lives were going places, like, you know, they had families and they were in jobs, they were employed again, and here I am hanging on, biting my fingernails, barely being able not to drink, going to meetings, barely able to hold a thought, was really uncomfortable. I would sit and say nothing. I would just sit because I was so uncomfortable. But I was trying to act as if I was sober, and I used to think that was so disingenuous because I wasn't. I mean, I was dry and I was trying to be sober, and I used to think that was disingenuous. This wasn't who I was. But one of the things I learned is by acting, trying to act like a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I became a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is very important to me. You know, one of the things I'm learning about is the subtleties of my life in like 6 and 7. And like in Virginia, they like you to dress. And so I'm sort of defiant. And I'm sitting in my house arguing with, I'm going to put a pair of jeans on and a nice shirt. And I have this dialogue. I'm like, well, you know what? I'm coming to their house. And one of the things they appreciate is that you look well when you go. But I'm defiant. But one of the things about 6 and 7 is I come here and I'm willing to say, okay, I'm coming to their home. And one of their requests to enter their home is to be presentable. But yet, I still have the dialogue about I don't want to be. I want to wear jeans and I want to wear a dress shirt. But I get dressed. And I'm still amazed that I behave like that in my head. You know what I mean? But because I look at things and I'm willing to try. And again, one of the things for singleness of purpose for me, I came to your home. And I asked you for your help because I couldn't do it. And I need to follow the way you want it. And singleness of purpose is huge for me. You know, we're not a catch-all and a saving grace for everyone. I don't come here to figure out my relationships. I don't come here to bake cakes. I come here to save my life, be a useful human being, and hopefully save someone else's and teach them how. But when all those other things come together, my relationships improve, my employment improves, everything around me improves, my family life improves. I don't know, I was a couple years sober, and I can remember my mom looking at me saying, I don't know who that girl was, but my daughter's back. Mm-hmm. I became a different human being at the end of my drinking than who I was when I started. And you brought me back to what I was and better, I think. I'm a better human being today, you know. So 8 was easy. I told you it was a list of harms. I didn't have to do that list, you know. Had a hard time with 9. You know, I had a lot of yah buts with 9. And my sponsor would go back and say, go back to 8. And some I could really do easily. And some I had a lot of yah buts. And, you know, I struggled with forgiveness. I know it's an old thought, but I think when I say I forgive you means that I'm telling you it's okay. I realize forgiveness is for me, and I get the intellectual, but the head and the heart, I feel like I'm saying your bad behavior is okay because I forgive you. And it really isn't, and I know that, but I forgive you for me so I have peace and I can move on. And because if I can't forgive you, I can't forgive me. And so it's an integral part, but I struggle with that. My mother is the most forgiving person on the planet, and I don't know how she does it. I really don't. And if I could be anything like 1/10 of my mom, I'd be an amazing human being. She has the capacity to forgive like nobody's business. I missed that lesson. So I did become willing, and I will say that 1 was not accepted. 1 was very egregious. and they didn't, they heard it. They said to my mother, it was very courageous what I did. Person never spoke to me. 20 years till they spoke to me. It was a family member that I would see every day, every year at Christmas. I'd give her space. You know, I would say hello. She never said what I did. I never did either, which was an amazing thing. And I would see her every year, and I would we would be cordial or civil. I'd maybe civil, and I would leave her alone because she really wanted nothing to do with me. 20 years goes by, and she asked me to go on a trip with her to Ireland. And I was like, wow. But it took 20 years. But I respected the boundary. I really hurt her. And she wasn't, I don't know if it wasn't forgive me, but she didn't want to trust me, maybe. And she didn't want me in her life. I guess maybe she wanted to see some proof. 10, I do that. I take a personal inventory. I look at my life. I see what's going on a day-to-day basis. I check my gut. Am I religious about how it is in the big book? Probably not. I'm pretty undisciplined. Some days I'm really, really good at things, and some days I'm not. I'd be lying to tell you if I was disciplined all the time. I'm just not. It says in the big book, I am undisciplined, and I'm better, and I do it more often than not. 11. I used to feel really bad about 11 until 3 weeks ago because I really didn't think I meditated. And I don't meditate in the form of, like, I sit and be still and like people do in the morning and read, and I do read and I do read. But I really felt like I was lacking, and I really felt less than. And I was on a hike. I do a lot of physical stuff. I hike, I go to the gym, I walk, whatever. I am in nature. And I met this woman that's in mindfulness that teaches at UVA, and there's such a thing as movement meditation. And that's what I do. And I really felt less than for 20 years because I don't do it as sitting in a room with a candle lit, opening a book. But I get with God when I walk and my mind is clear. And she told me that yoga was started so monks would move and be able to sit still and meditate. And there is such a thing as meditation and movement. And so that's where I find it. And I know it's for me. I hike all the time. I find God in my surroundings and in beauty and in outside. And so now I don't feel less than. I may not do it like it's laid out in the book where I sit every day, but I am still, but I do a lot of it by being very active. And that made me feel better because I always thought I was less than there. I know I've had a spiritual awakening because if you ask my mother, I'm a completely different human being. And I know that is because I come here. You know, and I'm going to end pretty much with this. And my life has changed immensely. And when I got here, the old timers where I came from would bang on the podium and scream, and they were pretty crotchety. And one of the things is they say is AA doesn't offer you anything but one day of sobriety. And that used to really offend me because I used to think, for me, it offered me so much more than a day of sobriety. Besides getting a day of sobriety, it offered me opportunities that I missed when I was drinking. It offered me the ability to be available and the daughter I always wanted to be or the friend or the employee I always wanted to be. I got so much more than a day of sobriety than coming here. And I got to be useful. I have a purpose today. I used to run around the world with no purpose, no direction. I have a purpose today. So I got more than a day of sobriety. But basically, I guess that's what it guarantees us. If we do it, it's laid out, we get a day. But I've gotten many, many, many gifts and opportunities because I come here. And one of the hardest things I heard about, and it took me 100 years to learn this, and they told me that I could find, you know, serenity in all the calamity. My world could be burning down around me, and I could be serene. And I thought, like, that is just rubbish. Absolute rubbish. You know, I'm a chaos junkie. You know, I was. I'm not anymore. I've learned how to feed that monster. I feed it in my professional life and what I do. I keep it on. I used to be in my personal life. It's not, but that's part of my makeup. And so I could not imagine, you know, my disease or my illness. Part of my illness is perspective. I have no perspective. Everything's a 10. Nothing's a 1. You know, everything's, you know, catastrophic. Nothing's minor. My sponsor used to rate my calamity. That's a 2. And I'd be like, it's a 12. And she was trying to help me get perspective on what was going on in my life. I had no perspective in my life. And so I just want to say this, you know, life happens. People die. People lose their children. Disease enters our lives, you know. Spouses lose their jobs. Marriages end. And my life didn't turn into a bowl of cherries. So, like, in October, my dad died from an illness of Alzheimer. December, I had a personal thing that I don't, you know, that happened in my life to me that was difficult. My daughter is an active heroin, you know, addict, and she's been using hardcore drugs since the age of 17. She's turning 25, and last week, her, you know, there's four of them. My daughter makes the fourth. There's three of them, and her 24-year-old friend died of a drug overdose, a heroin overdose. She'd been clean 6 months. Something happened. She went into the bedroom at her mom's house, shot a bag of dope, and just died. It was like 3 weeks ago. My daughter called me sobbing. I mean, my life isn't perfect, but I'm content, and I never thought I would be able to say I'm content. I have acceptance. You know, I have chosen to love my daughter at the way she is. You know, I have chosen. I've made a choice that I am not going to do the tough love. I did it at 17. It didn't work. I've decided that I'm going to love my daughter as she is. That my last conversation is not going to be, get clean or don't call me. It's just not. I'm going to accept where my daughter is at. Because I, God forbid, she has a heroin overdose, and that's our last conversation. And that's my choice. That's my personal choice. It's been a long time coming, you know, but that's my choice. I'm choosing to love my daughter as she is. You know, I have acceptance. This is where she's at. I don't know what the future holds. But I have a good life, and life is pretty calm today. You know, she's coming to see me. You know, when my dad died in October, my dad had a heart attack, I don't know, maybe I was like 24, 25, I was drinking, I was active as can be. It was awful. And I went to the hospital, and I couldn't let anybody touch me. And I couldn't let anybody comfort me. And I went straight to the bar. And my mother was heartbroken. She wrote me this long letter about how disappointed she was. She needed me to be at the hospital. And I wrote her this long letter back of why I couldn't be there and the deficiency in me. And, like, I needed to be away from that. And my dad dies. He's been dying for a long time. I've gone home more times than I can tell you to be with my mom before my dad dies. My dad dies, and my mother can do zero. She couldn't plan the funeral. She couldn't plan the bereavement dinner. She couldn't get the flowers. She couldn't pick out what she wanted at the service. She had me plan the whole thing. She's like, just take your friend and take your husband and just do whatever you want. I want a couple things, and will you please do that for me? Now, if I was drinking, think about how I was at 23. I couldn't even go into the hospital or be with my mother, but I planned my father's funeral. And I walked with my mother, and I sat with her through that. And she said, if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't have been able to get through it because I couldn't make a decision. I couldn't hold a thought, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And she's because I come here. I show up. It was quite unpleasant, quite frankly. You know, it was hard. I was grieving, she was grieving, but I was of service. That's what you taught me to do. You know? So I'm saying life happens. And Billy was just saying, it's what we do with what we get, dealt. You know? When I held my daughter in my arms, the first day she was born, that was not the future I envisioned. But it is the future we have. And yet, I'm sober. I'm a power of example, and she sent me this great card for my birthday saying about how much patience and tolerance I have for her and how I've always been there and how much I love her. And no matter what happens, she will know I love her. And I'll end with this. God, my sponsor said to me, when I struggled with, people say things like, it's God's will. And I'm like, seriously? I don't think it's God's will to take a child. I think that's self-will on some level of my child, but I don't think that's God's will. So she said, I don't know what God's will is, Linda, but maybe God's will or God's job is to stop the suffering. And maybe if Amanda dies, it's because he's stopping Amanda's pain. I can hold on to that. I can find comfort in that. And I stop worrying about the future. If God takes Amanda, but I learned that here from you people, that maybe his job is to stop the suffering. He stopped mine by my coming here. You know, he stopped the suffering in my family. By my getting sober, my mother doesn't wonder where I am when I'm coming back. You know, my mom's coming to visit me in May. I'm so excited. She hasn't been since my dad's been ill. She's spending 2 weeks with me. I'm tickled. I never thought she'd come since my dad's death. You know, and I'm going to be available. And I'm going to be present. I'm not going to work, and I'm going to be present. I learned that here. I've never been present. I'm present today. And I'm in people's lives. And it's all because of you. It's because I sat in these chairs and you taught me how to act appropriately. And that comes from 6 and 7, acting appropriately, learning how to act appropriately. Let me tell you, I didn't act appropriately a lot. My sponsor said for years I was going to teach people how to treat me. No idea what that meant. For years she told me, she would walk by me and say, I'm going to teach people how to treat you, Linda. And I'm like, what? I get it today. I'm a slow learner, you know, but I have learned how to teach, how to be, you know, how to treat people and how to be treated. And I also know there are some people in my life that I can't teach how to treat me. Mm-hmm. And then I walk away. Mm-hmm. You know, there are things I will accept and won't. And I can be kind and I can be loving, but you don't have to be in my inner circle. And I can understand that everybody's deeply flawed, including me. But there are some things I want to be treated with. And I don't have to have everybody in my world. But it doesn't mean I get to be mean, cruel, or unseemly with them. You know, and I try not to be. And I want to again say thank you for having me and for your courtesy of listening, and thank you.